Hello, this is Mary Cole and the Good Story Podcast, helping writers craft a good story. With me, you will hear from thought leaders related to writing, and sometimes not, about topics important to writers of all categories and ability levels. Here is to telling a good story. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a new audio and visual attempt at the Good Story Podcast. My name is Mary Cole, and with me I have the wonderful Jonathan Oxier. I will let him introduce himself, and then we are off to the races.
Hey, everybody. My name is Jonathan Oxier. I write strange stories for strange kids. Some of you might know my longer middle grade books like the Peter Nimble series or The Spooky Night Gardener or Sweep. I also have a brand new series that is out right now for younger readers, readers of all ages, really. It's called The Fabled Stables. The first book is called Will of the Wisp, and the second book just came out, and it's called Trouble with Tattletales. It's about a little boy named Augie who works in magical stables filled with all sorts of strange, unusual, one-of-a-kind creatures.
And they are beautiful. I was looking through all of the covers. They are so fun.
I was very, very excited. So even though I do draw and illustrate some of my novels, these books, we have an artist named Olga Demidova. And I, as a parent, really wanted books that had tons and tons of color, full color illustrations. So these books are basically, they're short. You read them about 15 minutes. But there's 100 pages of full-color illustrations by Olga, and they are just absolutely kind of candy-colored and amazing and silly and brilliant. I love them. I love the way they turned out. I can't take credit for how they look, but it's been really, really fun to actually get these physical copies, much more than my novels, frankly, because these are so much more nice, wonderful to kind of page through and hold in the hand.
I love them. I'm so excited for you to branch out and maybe to even hear, well, we'll see where the conversation takes us, but to hear how you sort of got around to middle grade, which I understand was maybe not your first writing love, and then got around to chapter books. So we can talk about kind of your own journey. But one of the things that I like that we kind of started talking about your covers, because one of the things that you are known for as a writer is your rich, detailed, very atmospheric world building. And that is sort of what I think of when I think of Sweep, when I think of Peter Nimble. I think about these sort of gothic, Victorian-esque, Dickensian worlds, but with a lot of glow and heart. It seems like you dwell in a little bit of that world for quite a few of your stories, or similar offshoots of that world. How did you arrive there?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a sound observation that I seem to have sort of a lane that I sort of landed in. And some of that were the dictates of the story. So both Night Gardener and Sweep are fantasies set in a literal historical backdrop of Victorian England. There's historical realities, especially in Sweep, which is really historically grounded, that I was working around. But certainly just a general aesthetic leaning toward that. World building is kind of a funny thing. So even early in my career, I started out wanting to be a playwright. I studied playwriting in graduate school. And even there, and certainly later in my life and writing career, when I tried branching out into screenwriting, and then books, people have often identified kind of very strong world building in my writing. What's sort of funny about that is I don't think I, as a writer, am really prioritizing that. So it's one of those compliments that I sort of am happy to hear, because we like compliments. It's also quite valued in certain arenas. So like when I was breaking out as a screenwriter or trying to, that was something that people identified, like, oh, we need someone who can really, you know, do strong world building. My sense, though, is that I've never been totally convinced that a lot of the people who talk about world building even have a clear sense of what they mean by it.
Fabulous.
But I don't have a good answer. I would love to like take down the dogma and give you this shining new clear thing. But I really, what it comes down to is, I think like anything, world building is something that can be done. It's not a question of whether it exists or doesn't exist. It's a question of whether it's done well or not done well. And I think you can have very world-buildy stories that are a giant mess and don't actually take you into a world. And then you can have a very grounded, real story that makes the world real. And so really, to me, world building is like a shorthand that people use to talk about almost like set design and flavor and tone. But usually when they're excited about it, it's not actually the set design and the flavor and tone they're excited about. They're excited about the fact that they could basically fully visualize the space and actually just we're experiencing the story as though it were happening to them. And so I think sometimes I feel like people use world building as the way to say, I felt like I was in a world, but
yeah.
Set design is not actually the best way to make you feel like you're inside a world. It works a little bit. I mean, we've all been on like amazing Disney rides that like, oh yeah, I really feel like I'm in a haunted house for a second. And so it's a tool to help create that immersion. But I don't actually think it's the thing itself. This is the first time I'm articulating these thoughts, so I might retract them in a minute.
No, I love it. And I was going to say, you know, I think it's very interesting that this is what you, what a lot of people call out in your work. You had started as a playwright, you did some screenwriting, and there in film and on the stage, the visual world is created by the visual elements of those crafts, which are set design. And of course, in film, you have a whole visual component that works in chorus with the actual words that characters are speaking. You know, if there is any set description, it's like smash cut interior daytime. You know, that's kind of the writing that goes into creating the world in a basic screenplay. And so it's really interesting for me that that was your genesis as a writer. And yet you have all of these accolades for creating the atmospheric world on the page.
Well, and some of that is actually makes a lot of sense. I would say that I am, and I would own, well, no one compliments me for this, but I wish they would, because I think it's true. I am a highly visual writer. I was a late bloomer as a writer. I thought I was going to be an artist pretty much my whole life until I, you know, got into my early 20s.
A visual artist.
Yeah. I didn't write very much. I was always coming up with stories, but I was thinking very visually. So, you know, as a young adolescent, I'm like, well, you know, a film director does those things. It turns out I hate cameras. And so I was like, well, I don't want to spend my life, you know.
Behind one of these things.
I spoke with a director once who said something. He was a writer, a screenwriter, and a movie director. He preferred his screenwriter identity. And the way he described directing was, he said, it takes a very special kind of creativity to film someone walking down a driveway for 8 hours. which actually like sparked with me, because I'm like, well, what am I willing to do for 8 hours? I am willing to polish a sentence. Maybe not 8 hours, but you know.
Have you ever worked on a sentence for 8 hours?
Yeah. We can talk about my tortuous writing process later, but
this sounds great. I would love to.
It's one step forward, 9 steps back.
Perfect.
But not to sidestep this point. So I'm a very, even when I started writing because I learned I actually wasn't that great of an artist. I had a lot of images and ideas and kind of really fundamentally visuals that I wanted to put into the world. They were all narrative. They were stories. And I wasn't a good enough artist to turn them into stories. And so I like looked around and I'm like, well, if you can write, you can create any visual. I started in theater, I think mainly because of access. I had been acting in theater programs. I was familiar with theater, and the barriers to entry are actually quite low. You can, you know, theater classes are available in your high school and, you know, in university doesn't take a lot to mount a little production. It takes a lot to publish a book, and it takes much more than a lot to make a movie. But you can just you can just practice a scene with something and make something come alive, you know, in an afternoon. And so theater was my way in because of that access. What I learned in graduate school was that with some very meaningful exceptions, theater, or I'll call it dramatic writing, is fundamentally does not tell story through images. Stage plays can occasionally have very arresting images, but the way action unfolds in theater is through dialogue, right? You think of Shakespeare as the extreme example. The only stage directions we get are like, he dies, or, you know, exit, right? And
I saw your blog post about Hamlet. The Prince of Denmark, just like, it's one word, dies.
And that's actually, I mean, that's an extreme example, but that's what all theater does, is the action happens in dialogue, in words spoken by characters. And I actually learned that I kind of had a tin ear, not for having characters speak like humans, but for having story action occur through dialogue. Which
interesting. That's a really granular distinction.
Super granular. It took me a year of my MFA instructor yelling at me that I didn't understand the concept before I could even understand that I didn't understand the concept. Because he's like, you are not doing actions. And I'm like, there's actions. She slaps him. And he's like, that's not a story action. That's not dramatic action. That's just a verb. And this was like really deep, complex stuff. And I really developed those skills a lot, but I also kind of developed a sense that, like, this isn't the stuff that I love. There's some people who can tell stories through their dialogue, and that's the way the story moves. I think those people often transfer not only from theater, but I actually think that's a sort of a hidden ingredient of graphic novels. Mm. That's really hard to for me to actually figure out. I think there's a temptation to write a graphic novel like you would a screenplay and be like, well, the artist will do it all. Graphic novels are wildly different because they can't show actions, right? You can't draw someone without silly cartoon lines. You can't draw someone doing a double take, let alone slapping someone. You can show the moment before the slap, the moment after the slap. You can't actually show the action. And really great comics often have characters saying stuff that if you filmed it in a movie would look really, really bad. I recently reread Neil Gaiman's Sandman series, which was deeply affecting to me growing up. And I knew they were going to finally make a movie out of it. And I kept on trying to just shoot the movie in my head as I'm reading these stories. And it would just be the worst scene you've ever seen. It works wonderfully on a comic page because a comic needs the action to move through dialogue. But if you just really literally transcribed that brilliant comic to the screen, you would think it would be a one-to-one translation, but I think they have to do a lot of work because it's a totally different medium. I can't even remember your initial question other than to say that
we were talking about world building eons ago, but I love this kind of the difference between a screenplay, a graphic novel script, a play, like a piece of play writing, mm-hmm. a drama, manuscript.
A script. I don't know. A play script. I don't know. I use script when I talk about plays.
I was a theater major. Oh my gosh. No, I really like this. Give me an example of, okay, I'm really going to put you on the spot here, but can you give me an example of how dialogue moves action forward, maybe in one or two of these mediums, just compare and contrast?
So in a graphic novel, you often, I mean, I can't even remember. I picked up a comic my daughter was reading, and I can't for the life of me remember what it was. I don't think it was Bone, but it was something like that. And it's just the first panel was the character literally, like, they were like clearly like marching out of the house. But all we had was the image of them marching out of the house. And so the character was saying, you know, something to the effect of, what a great day to plant some seeds in the old garden. If you filmed that, it would look idiotic. Because we can see the garden, we can literally see what they're about to do. The pleasure of, say, a movie is watching the action unfold and tell us what's happening. That would be the epitome of hack writing to have a character say that. Instead, they might say, what a beautiful day, but that we can even say. And so the dialogue does different things. The dialogue sort of is used to reveal character much more, the personality of like, oh, way too sunny for me, right? Or something like that.
Right.
This is, you'd think it's a beautiful, you know, you use the dialogue in screenwriting to reveal character and theme, and certainly sometimes plot or necessary exposition, but it's not the fundamental language of cinema. The comic book needs that so that you can get to the next panel. Otherwise, the comic takes 500 pages. And certainly some comics I've seen are like actually trying to storyboard the thing. And it's, you would think that's like this beautiful artistic thing, but it's actually a really, to me, a very uneven reading experience where I'm like, I'm flipping pages every 3 seconds and oh, now I have to stop. And it's going to take me 4 minutes to get through this conversation. And then it speeds up again. And I think that's an example of kind of asking one medium to use the language of another one. So I don't know if that succeeds as an example for you.
And maybe in a graphic novel with the idea of kind of walking out of the house and, you know, having them say, oh, I'm going to do some gardening or whatever, time to prime the garden. I'm not a gardener. So I've now failed at theater terms, gardening terms. But the scope compared to film, you know, we'd be able to see the garden behind them. We'd be able to see all this. In terms of a panel, it is very restrictive. So we are only able to see so much. And so the dialogue has to do a little bit more work, or the narrative, kind of the little narrative strips, if those are included, kind of the prose of the graphic novel, have to do a little bit more work. And the reader also then has to do more work bridging from panel to panel. So if there's a shift in the action or a shift in perspective, that happens more in the reader's mind. Whereas in film, it's sort of laid out for us to sort of consume.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, I don't know what mastery of that looks like, but I agree that I think there's a mistake made when we assume one medium translates really easily and neatly into the other. And so, again, for me, I had a lot of story ideas. I got to theater and I spent, you know, I went to a really good MFA program. I spent years honing that craft. But my ultimate takeaway was like, this is going to be, you know, like, working with one hand tied behind my back for the rest of my career, because I am a visual storyteller and the visual is central. And I will once in a while get to tell stories through visual in theater. But there are other modes of storytelling, like cinema, that are 99% visual, right? And, you know, so I actually, in my second year of graduate school, I took what I referred to as a vow of silence, because I really wanted to understand what dialogue was, in part to understand what my MFA director was yelling at me about. And so for a whole year, I only watched silent movies. And I watched tons and tons and tons of them. And I became kind of briefly obsessed with the form, which really informed a lot of my writing moving forward. But the general experiment I was doing, and a lot of these early silent movies are visually brilliant, because before they needed to add sound recording technology, the cameras were quite small and nimble. So the cinematography in some of these early pictures, once they get past like the first, you know, a decade or two of moving pictures, they're really, really vibrant and rich. Again, because the cameras can be little and are much more nimble. And one of the things you notice is any one of these movies, it's going to have a couple of cards slotted in with dialogue.
Yeah.
And you suddenly realize, oh, here's where the dialogue, the story can't happen without these words out of this person's mouth. And when you start paying attention to really the 10 sentences that whatever a movie like The General requires in order to function, you're like, okay, I guess for this mode, for writing for cinema, maybe I only need the 10 sentences. And so my writing got really kind of much more stripped down. The screenplay that I sort of went into my screenwriting career as my calling card was an hour long silent movie, which would never get made. It would have been gloriously expensive because it was very visual, and very world building. And it was silent, or it had no dialogue. It was a very noisy movie, but it was noisy in the language of cinema rather than the language of dialogue, which is just wasn't necessary for that script. And that was me sort of leaning completely into what that medium does.
Did that hush your teacher up a little bit when you came out with that?
So in that instance, I had a radical sort of ugly duckling transformation in graduate school. This was a very small program. I think they took 5 people a year. This guy would not have had a career in 2021. In a moment when we're looking at bad bosses, this was a really toxic man. I mean, screaming, throwing things at us, horrific insults, like as sort of debasing and awful as it can be. I don't know if you saw the movie Whiplash. I think Whiplash is a masterpiece.
I'll add it to my list.
It really captures the the perversity and complexity of the dynamic between a demanding instructor and a promising person who is making the mistake of needing their approval. I also think ultimately it's a very complicated set of reflections I have. I do not like the guy who ran the department personally for what I experienced. I am quite convinced that I would not have emerged as the writer that I was. Similar to the sort of military boot camp experience, we are actually putting you through hell because we know that hell is coming and we need you to know what it looks like. And we need you to have sort of the internal motivation to draw upon because the external motivation will never be there consistently. And in fact, the external will usually be pushing against you.
Like self-preservation, get out of here. So you have to go dig deep.
You have to be the thing forcing yourself to do this unpleasant thing. So I see the value of that philosophy, but I also think a lot of potentially wonderful writers are destroyed in that process, and I think there's a great tragedy. I think it's a tool for a certain writer. It might have even been the tool I needed. It is not a tool for every writer. I think it's a mistake to romanticize that sort of instruction. Which is complicated, though, because I needed it. I had come from a touchy-feely world prior to that with a lot of adult and mentor support, and that got me into a good graduate program, but it wasn't actually valuable past that. I needed to develop some other things.
So you found that you really needed that kind of crucible experience.
Yes.
To emerge.
And the answer, so to speaking with that, so I was on the chopping block. Every year he was always threatening to cut at least one person from the program, and I had come straight through undergrad, whereas most of the people in the program were several years older. Some of them were, you know, in their early 40s and had, you know, run theater companies and really had a lot of experience. I was a child. I was a worse writer than everyone. I was desperate for approval. It was my first time living away from family. All of this going on. And the first year, you could just smell my desperation and weakness. I think I sort of had a stink on me. And my writing was desperate. I was writing it for other people. And then between my first and second year, I actually started to write a letter to friends and family explaining why I was going to drop out of the program. Instead, I wrote the first chapter of Peter Nimble. I'd never written a word of fiction prose before in my life.
It makes a lot more sense because I read on your website that Peter Nimble was sort of a side project, right? You were involved in this program. You were studying something completely different. And I think you phrased it like, oh, to blow off steam or whatever. I had no idea that there was a lot of steam to blow off, but that was sort of the outlet, it seems like, when you were doing this personal growth, this professional growth, this writerly growth, you know, thinking about quitting, all of this very intense stuff. There, we meet watching silent movies, but a little pressure release turned into prose, which is now what you do primarily. So talk about how you sort of arrived at that little escape.
So that book, I wrote the whole first draft of Peter Nimble in a month. And it was rough first draft, but I'd never written a word of prose. And then I somehow, whatever I learned doing that, I came back to my second year of graduate school, a completely transformed writer. And I came back as one of the strongest students in the program. In part because I no longer cared about the people whose approval I needed, which is this sick cosmic joke about that fits into relationships, you know, when you let it go, when you don't need someone, suddenly they appear, you know, all of these sorts of things. That was true in my writing. I took opportunity where I found it, which was theater wasn't going to work for me. I was a more visual writer. I had opportunity in terms of kind of grants and some access for screenwriting. So I moved out to Los Angeles. All my friends went to New York. I was very sad because I prefer New York. As a city, but I wanted to go where opportunity was. And that was the point at which Peter Nimble became a sort of my enjoyable side gig, because it turned out I didn't really love screenwriting. I didn't have the temperament for pitching. I hate having to pitch or sell an idea that I haven't actually written, because it might be terrible. I know that. I throw out so much of my writing. So the idea that I'm like telling you how great this thing is, it feels really sickening to me.
You did pretty poorly in LA, where the hot air, that's what accounts for their perfect climate, is just all the hot air coming out of everyone.
I did okay. There was a point I got like a big agent early on. I sold some things. I was like making some money paying, living off of writing, so which is a success. I wasn't getting anything produced. I was just also looking down the road and realizing I'm not proud of what I'm writing and the opportunities I was seeing. You know, I sold a TV show a week before the writer's strike in 2007. So I kind of came out of the gates and then got kneecapped
into a wall.
Yeah, there you go. But I, you know, over a couple of years, basically, I noticed that the only writing I was excited about was that I would pick away at that manuscript for that novel I had written between graduate school years. And so that was where it became like, I realized, you know, this is clearly what I love. Like the other stuff is exhausting. It stokes my insecurities instead of sort of assuaging them. Peter Nimble, really, that manuscript was kind of a happy place for me. And so I spent like a happy several years kind of just picking at it and revising it and tweaking it, which was terrific. And it finally, I kind of finally hit a point where I realized like, actually the real point was when my big movie agent, read the book and was like, we're setting this up as a movie tomorrow. And inside he's like, great, this is great. We'll set this up as a movie. And this was a moment where everyone's so hot for IP.
Yeah.
You know,
they
want to, everyone's adapting comics and graphic novels. And,
yep.
And so if you have an existing piece of property, and I remember, you know, this is an agent I was scared of. I laughed at jokes that weren't funny. I did anything to make him like me. And he's like, we're setting this up as a movie. And I remember this like instant clarity. And I was like, no, this is a book. I don't want this to be a movie. I need this to be a book. And he didn't deal with book rights. And so he like threw a tantrum and called a guy who got me a book agent so I could sell this dumb little book so that he could then turn it around as a movie.
So that he could come back to the film world, yeah.
And by the time the book actually happened and I actually met someone in publishing, you know, my book agent was a delight. He actually was a reader instead of just being, you know.
Nobody in the film world reads.
Yeah. So you were a book agent. So you understand you're a wonderful breed. The movie agent people, they're very smart and some of them are nice, good people, but they're not my people. I wasn't comfortable with them.
Well, your cohort went to New York.
Yeah.
And I think mentally and emotionally you went to New York too. You just had your body just walked around LA for a while before you got, you know, you're not in New York City itself, but your work is produced in New York.
Yes.
Rather than Los Angeles.
It could be just a temperament thing. But it's just also the types of people, you know, I just felt like people would be more direct with me if something was wrong. They would tell me if they liked something. I was able to believe the compliment. I had so much more control over the work. I knew at any moment I could just say no. And that was really freeing. And that often gave me the permission to say yes to a note, knowing that I didn't have to. Whereas if you're dealing with a studio or a development exec, they give you the note and they're like, you don't have to do this. But you're like, well, I kind of do.
But yeah, they're going to find the hot new thing tomorrow. I mean, we're kind of villainizing the film industry, but it's that it works completely differently. And there's this kind of real lack of preciousness that and preciousness can be really good. And it can also be kind of a hindrance for writers. And I think in New York, we do celebrate the good kind of preciousness where we're all together trying to make beautiful books for children. You know, you say strange books for strange kids, which I love. Everybody kind of operates on the same mission. And in LA, it's kind of like everyone's on the hot new scent and then the wind changes and everyone's on the other hot new scent. And there's not so much attachment to sort of this book of your heart idea.
Yeah, and I don't need to necessarily villainize it. I think I can be very explicit about the fact that it was not a good fit for me. I didn't have the temperament for it. And some of it's like stuff like I am unusually bad at bouncing between ideas. It takes me about 2 weeks to pull my brain out of one idea and start another. Screenwriting is all about having five or six ideas going. You meet with, you know, executive on a general, they're like, oh, we've got this short story we want to adapt. What do you think? And a writer who can thrive in that world is able to read the short story, go, yeah, okay, I have an idea. I got 3 free days. Let me put something together. It would literally take me 1 to 2 weeks to just remove my head from whatever I was in. And those weeks felt like waste. Like I was so glacial at bouncing from idea to idea. And that's a survival skill. It's not one person being better than another, but that was a legitimate creative and cognitive limitation that I had that pretty much precluded me from being able to capitalize on whatever opportunity I was being offered or given there. I'm just a very slow and deliberate thinker, and I speak very quickly, but I process and think very slowly. And it just, again, I didn't have the temperament for that world. So it's not that like, I was too good for LA. I think I could have stuck it out, and maybe that lottery ticket I was kind of, getting might've actually won out. I can't see the future, but I did project into a future in LA, and I was asking like, well, what if I got the thing I'm desperate to get?
Yeah.
And it didn't, I could see very clearly that I still wouldn't be happy. And so leaving Los Angeles to live in an ordinary town, not ordinary, a magnificent town like Pittsburgh, writing kids books where I can just kind of slowly tend my own garden. Those were really crucial to my specific temperament. Because I have the time and patience for words, and for my stories when they're mine. I get along better with the people involved, publishers, editors, agents in the book world, librarians, teachers, other writers. So it's just a fit question. And it took me a while to find that fit. But I'm really glad I did. I don't spend a lot of time, wishing I were still a playwright or something. Yeah.
I think a lot of writers really struggle with this idea of what they should be doing, how they should operate. But that's why we have a world where we talk in terms of plotters versus pantsers, of people who can juggle multiple projects, people who really cannot. And I think a lot of people get far down a road and feel badly, or they feel not like they're functioning at their full potential or whatever, because they're trying to sort of fit themselves into these various molds that just might not be a fit. So I think the process that you went through, while it sounds like it took a while, and you say, I move at a pretty glacial pace to get to these kind of realizations, I think at the end, it was absolutely worth it to end up where you needed to be. And you've picked up a lot of insight along the way. So I don't think it's like, for me, a lot of writers come to me and they say, this didn't go anywhere. This didn't get picked up. I wasted all this time. I don't think any time that is spent writing or sort of exploring the options in the writing world, because you've done playwriting, you've done screenwriting, you now do novel writing and chapter book writing. None of it is, all of these are different disciplines, but they all contribute to your overall sense as a writer and a creative. And so I don't think any of that time was wasted, nor is a drawer manuscript, the time spent writing or revising a drawer manuscript, wasted.
I agree with that. I just recently finished a book that came out called Range. I can't remember the name of the author, but it's the subtitle is like how generalists succeed in a world of increasing specialization. It's something like that. And clearly the book just wants to be, run counter to a lot of sort of 10,000 hours type critiques. David Epstein. Yeah. The book was in many, those books are always a little uneven because someone is so excited about like their thesis about like, here's how my idea is different than all other ideas that have happened, and, take it with a grain of salt. But there was something really therapeutic about the book because it talked at length about basically the value in sort of having a broader range of experience. And there's one way to tell my story where I came out of the gates really fast. Like I was youngest person in my graduate program. I went, first person to get like a major agent, out of my cohort, managed to like break into an industry, abandon the industry, turn around, start a new career, and still have my first novel published when I was 29. So by most standards, like that's like someone who never took a break and just was pursuing, one thing relentlessly. But internally, there were an enormous number of moments where I like walked away from what felt like the path that I had fought very hard to forge in front of me. And that book talked quite a bit about how we don't celebrate enough walking away from things. Like there's a fetishization in, say, startup culture of like, your failures make you stronger. But that's still this sort of myopic focus on like, don't let anything get in the way of the path you've set. And this book talked really, I think, generously and wonderfully about, like, no, there's this other thing, which is just walking away.
Yeah.
Right when the thing is there. Like, this is like tenaciously pursuing X because you have decided X is the thing can occasionally be counterproductive and nonsensical, or at least soul crushing. The sadness of
the well, a light crushing of the soul.
a little soul crush is a given in human existence, I think. But so that was really liberating because I work pretty hard to not dress up sort of my failures at certain attempts as like, I was too good for this, right? Like,
right.
It's a confluence of things. Part of the reason I also didn't pursue playwriting is because it became very clear to me that literally no one makes a living at it. And I'm pragmatic that way as well, where I was like, well, if this is my passion and my dream and I want to do it full time, you know, like there's Lin-Manuel Miranda and no one else. And even he's doing a million side gigs.
Right.
and so I was like, well, that wouldn't work. And so when I was pursuing, you know, screenwriting, I part of me was pursuing, like, it felt like there's a job here. The thing I started to realize with screenwriting, which I think has only become much, much more true, especially if you're not interested in television, which I wasn't, is you can make a killing, but you can't make a living. Is sort of the joke they say about screenwriting careers. And I was like, well, I just want to make a living. I don't want to make a killing. And
yeah,
children's publishing, even different than adult literary fiction, certainly different than writing poetry or short fiction, which is you really need to sort of support yourself usually through teaching and MFA programs and things yes. like that. But with children's writing, it was having this new sort of market explosion post Harry Potter. There was all of this interest, there was money, there was sort of new legitimacy in the industry. It happened to be the thing I also loved. And really you're looking for that confluence of like, what's the thing I love enough to stick with it, which is really to me, the definition of passion is just kind of patience and the ability to take pleasure even when the thing isn't easy or fun.
I love that.
Which is different than like aptitude. Again, writing is not my first creative language at all. And so it was that confluence, and it took some trial and error to find the thing that both I loved, felt like I was equipped to do, and I could get paid for. And for my money,
make a steady living. Yeah.
Oh, I've made so much more money on books than I ever did in screen. And I've like, you know, I sold a movie to Disney. I wrote the screenplay for them. Like I've done some big things, and the individual check that's written might be larger than some of my publishing checks. But like in aggregate, I've been publishing books for this summer will bring me to 10 years since my first novel was published. You and I are both quite old, Mary.
yes, so yeah, I see that in the mirror every day that I look.
Because I feel like it was, I remember again, knowing your blog, right when blogging was super important, my first book came out and so I was familiar with you that way. But I think it's a testament that like we're both still here. That speaks to like the ability to make a living in, it's not easy. But the number of people who have said, I want to become a screenwriter that I'm like, don't do it. Write some books. You have so much more control and you will get paid more. And you don't have to live in LA, which is a city that I find not fun to live in.
I'm from Northern California, the real California, to be clear. So I couldn't agree with you more. I have been kind of swirling on this one point you made. I really want to shine a light on it real quick, which is in your study of these silent movies, you notice that they only, you know, there's a whole story, right? But we only have these like 10 dialogue cards. And so you basically identified that a story destined for film, a story with this visual storytelling component can actually be pretty simple, which is where I think we get the pitch, right? The pitch can be, you know, a girl gets into Harvard Law School to win her boyfriend back. Beautiful pitch. Doesn't even matter what the movie is about on a scene to scene level. But the idea of the movie is so transmittable. It's so consumable. If you don't like that pitch, here's another pitch. But the real underpinnings of those types of stories that I think it seems you discovered do so well in film, they really are like two or three bullet points that you get. And then it's a whole idea and you don't like that. Here's another one, you know, and you identified that you are not necessarily set up or equipped to operate that way. But I do think that it's a really interesting way of looking at an entire idea can come down to just 10 lines of dialogue.
Yeah, I think I would separate those two. I think I hear what you're saying about like the one sentence pitch, and I actually think the one sentence pitch, I test pitches really carefully with my writing, and it's easy to do because it's often after the fact, but I'm doing pre-COVID tons and tons of events at schools, and I am pitching my books, and I'll hold up, you know, all four books, and I'll give them each a one sentence pitch, and I can. It's not even like reading their faces. They're kids. They're excited to not be in class, hopefully. but I can hear it coming out of my mouth that I'm like, that's not actually the fun thing that makes everyone lean in. And I believe figuring out a really clean pitch teaches you about what the appeal of your story is. And sometimes it runs contrary to what you think the story is. So I pitch once I get into a book and get rolling, I pitch it a lot because I find that's like a divining rod that shows me the sort of real heart of the thing.
Yeah.
I would say the lack of dialogue in, say, a silent movie, what I'm really just observing there is that for me, it was understanding that every medium has its own tools that are best suited for it. It doesn't mean you can't make a super talky movie where the action happens in dialogue, but it's not what the medium wants. And figuring out like, well, where are you fighting against the medium and where are you working with the medium strength? So again, movies are pretty unusual in a couple of ways, but one of the ways is obviously a moving picture is one of the only things that can actually show action occur across time, right? Even in comics, as we said, like there's the gap. You
don't get the moment of the slap. You don't get the smack of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You might draw some speed lines or something, but like it's still a cheat. It's still lines. Yeah. And the slap happens in the reader's mind. It's still as effective. Cinema can actually do the movement. So can video games, really. So it was just basically teaching myself to take really seriously, like what medium am I working in and what does it want? What does it allow and what doesn't it allow? And I will be totally honest, with my first book, Peter Nimble, I don't think I had, it was a very voicey book in kind of this tweety way that has some appeal to it. But it wasn't until my second book, The Night Gardener, that I started actually understanding some of the unique tools and you could even say expectations or requirements of prose writing in terms of how POV works, which is super, super hard to teach. In the same way that my MFA director yelled at me about not knowing how to tell stories with dialogue, I find I don't yell, but when I'm working with writers, it's very hard for me to explain that basically every problem they have could be solved if they had a better command of point of view. And point of view is an incredibly nuanced and complex subject. It's not like first person, second person, third person. Like that's what you learn in high school.
Yeah.
But actually a strong command of POV is extremely complex. And I don't even have the vocabulary to teach it, I've learned. But I also think it's the whole thing. If you have mastery of POV, the story, this goes all the way back to your initial question, that's when the world comes alive. Because that's what lets the reader fully inhabit the story and inhabit the space of the story and the world of the story.
So for you, that the character is really the conduit.
There's two things
there. Point of view. Yes.
So point of view, I think, is very delicate control over levels of immersion. And one is going to bring you into the character and one's going to bring you into the world. And also even above the world, the author's mind. And I think that's something that fiction does better than almost any medium, is really great books. You're living inside the character. You're analyzing and experiencing the world as sort of a bigger phenomenon. And then you're also sliding into the mind of the creator and having a conversation with them because they're telling you what they think about the world based on the world they've created and the character they've created and the outcomes of certain actions. And, again, this is where POV is so complicated because it's so easy to start violating or accidentally pull the reader into one of those three states, and there's probably more than three states, in a way that's not helpful. And you don't even realize you're doing it. And it took me years and years to even understand. I'd have much more experienced writers be like, "You're slipping on POV here." And I'm like, "No, I'm not. It's still in third person." And they're like, "Eh." And it was the same problem from graduate school all over again, where I'm like, I literally don't understand the problem that you say you're identifying.
Yeah.
And it took me years. And you had a second observation about world building that connected to that I've lost about POV. Oh, the other thing is you talk about centering it on character.
I'm in the three strata of POV right now. So I literally like...
Welcome to a conversation with me. I move a lot.
I just want to let listeners know that, we were doing our kind of banter and you were like, "Well, you know, like you can ask any question as long as you're okay with me, jumping off the premise or disagreeing with the premise of the question." I have loved this conversation because I kind of go in with my like broad baseball bat of understanding. And I'm like, "Let's smash these two ideas together." You're like, no, my friend, there is some nuance here. I love that you are drilling into it. So,
well, and sometimes I say a thing and it doesn't feel true an hour later. So take everything with a grain of salt. I'm processing some of this as I speak.
Yeah.
So, but I want to go back to the other thing you talked about. So that was the POV thing, but you did mention sort of character as a conduit into world building, and the way in which I have found that helpful to think about, and I actually do in graduate programs, I do a workshop on this that I really love. I don't know if students, I have no idea if it works for them, but it's really helpful for me because it's been, as I've figured out my own process in writing these fantasy worlds, I've figured out that it's really central. And it has to do with basically that, I'm not that interested in a super built world, like the in a world where sort of mentality, and we get this not just in movie trailers, but I think we see it a lot in YA. We see it in middle grade as well. We see it all over media where it's like just the elaborate hook and premise of the environment. And again, some of that set design, but there's usually a really hooky idea in a world where everyone is like X and like, you know, you're in this weird dystopia, whatever. The thing that I find important for me as a writer to get me writing those sorts of stories in a way that the story starts coming alive and sort of showing me where it wants to go is basically really, really aggressively reverse engineering. So let's say I have an idea for a world with a core metaphorical premise, which 99% of fantasy does.
Yeah.
Fantasy that moves us and means something and resonates with our own lives. It all has some of it somewhere, some metaphorical resonance. I'm really aggressive once I have that flavor of that world to basically reverse engineer the protagonist.
Mm.
And one of the things that does, and I think actually we're seeing this is a new thought I'm having, but basically I'm telling a story. The world is only important because of how that specific character is built and oriented, and that the problems that character has and that they're going to have to grow through are exactly sort of almost a mirror image or deeply, deeply related to the fundamental problem or question of the world itself.
Mm.
And there is a different kind of world-building storytelling that's much closer to video games, or even if you want to go back earlier, what L. Frank Baum did with the Oz stories, which after Wizard of Oz, I would argue, are all quite unreadable. And it's basically you make a giant world where any story can happen. Gene Roddenberry did this, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to go super old, you could argue that Walter Scott did this with the Waverly novels. And the argument I've made often that I'm about to refute is that George Lucas did this, the Star Wars universe. 10 million yeah. stories can be told in Star Wars.
Yeah.
But also, I would argue that the reason we have to see the Death Star be blown up 10,000 times and 90% of the stories coming out of the Star Wars universe are about a boy named Luke and his daddy named Anakin, and the same sets of problems echoed all the way into the, you know, episodes 7, 8, and 9, is because whether people, the creators, understand it or not, George Lucas's world wasn't this broad platform that could easily tell a million stories. It was actually a really limited platform, and it's not actually a very consistent world. Like, the ability to poke holes in the Star Wars universe, such as Luke Skywalker is 17 years old. His father was the Jedi who destroyed the galaxy, and yet no one remembers the Jedi. It's 17 years. That's that's much less time, or several years shorter than like 9/11. The idea that no one remembers the Jedi and the Force.
Hush, 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 hush. This is a blasphemy.
It's not blasphemy when that story, that first story happened, because the point was what the journey that Luke goes on. My guess is that's the reason all of the attempts, there's other reasons that attempts to deepen the Harry Potter world have fumbled. some of them are related to its author. But I also think, I think there's a deeper reason, which is Hogwarts makes no sense except to the boy living under the stairs.
Yeah.
And to him, to his journey, it makes perfect sense. But it turns out, you know, the magic trick of making us feel like the Star Wars universe or the Wizarding world is endless. All they had to do was make us feel that way so that we could follow that individual. So when I'm writing fantasy stories, as soon as I get that hook, okay, there's a universe where there's a force, a good side, an evil side, they're always at war, blah, blah, blah. Then I go, I'm really disciplined where I'm like, well, who needs that story to happen to them? The best example of this would be my third book, Sophie Choir and the Last Story Guard. In many ways, this is actually my favorite book I wrote. I really, really love it. It didn't find as many readers as some of my other books, which breaks my heart. But every once in a while, a Sophie Riedel will show up in a signing line. I get really excited. But that was a world where I had already decided that basically it was this small town in sort of this fantasy setting that had collectively decided to turn its back on. They have a city ordinance called No Nonsense, and everyone is literally burning and throwing away all of the fairy tales and the folklore that had informed their entire culture and sense of place in the world, because they want to kind of march into this bright, modern, more rational future. And there is ideas to tease out with that. Kind of big picture ideas about the meaning of the world. But the thing I had to do over and over again was take a breath and go, I need a kid, a character, a hero for whom this world is a direct challenge to their identity. And if they are not, again, mirror image is the wrong word, but that's the best I have.
Foils? Like
the foil. So the world is the foil to the child. The problems of the world are a reflection or a connection to the problems within the child, the hopes, the aspirations of the child. And I find when you get that resonance, and it doesn't have to be super sophisticated, right? I think Bilbo Baggins in The Shire is a foil to the epic scope of what's going to happen with hunting down Smaug and the Battle of the Five Armies. So it doesn't have to be, you're not always making Neo in The Matrix, right? That's some obvious math of like... You know, here's the computer simulated, you know, prison we're all in. And here's the hacker who, you know, sees past all this and can swallow the right pill and bend a spoon. I can't remember, but you don't always have to do that perfect math. But I think on an emotional level, you need the journey that this story is going to represent. The problems that this world represents are super, super intimate and localized. And that's how the world goes from just busy set design to like something we feel. You know, Katniss to me is like one of the best examples. I think you could have created the Hunger Games world, and if you didn't have Katniss at the center of it, it would have just been nonsense. It wouldn't have resonated at all.
I was thinking about that when you were saying, you know, these high concept worlds where it's like kids are killing one another, you know, but I think you're right. Katniss anchors that kind of ridiculous high premise, you know, to use a pitchy type of term, you know, she really anchors that. And for her, that is the exact world that she needs to fight through to stand for what she believes in. And I think this goes back to your version of a pitch and your version of this kind of the heart of the story, the thesis statement of the story. And I love that you're sort of doing this dance between the character and the world where they really do fit perfectly to convey whatever the bigger idea is. And you can't do it without the right character in the right world.
one of the best things that might have led me to this sense of thinking, this is when I was young and in LA and starting out as a screenwriter. I had a friend who ended up, now he's writes entertainment stuff. He's the carpetbagger at New York Times. So he's rocketed up. He's a wonderful guy, Kyle Buchanan. And he was like early days of like blogging his movie reviews and like doing as a side gig and kind of, you know, this is 15 years ago. And the movie Crank, which I'm sure you all own on DVD. The premise is something like a guy has like a bomb put inside him. And like if his heart rate goes below a certain point, he blows up.
Speed, but not with a bus.
It's with your body. Yeah, so okay. The premise is like, you like if these action adventure movies are like about adrenaline, this is a guy who like literally if the adrenaline stops, it's all over. But they cast Jason Statham, who like is, you know, this tough guy soccer hooligan who like is already, he's ready, wired for action, you know, the moment he wakes up in the morning. And so it's like, oh yeah, well, this guy's going to be able to like, he's going to be able to handle this no problem, because he'll kill whoever, you know, whatever, he'll break your arm, he'll do whatever it takes. And this friend of mine, he just made a really simple observation when he saw this you know, movie coming out, or maybe it was already out, and he's like, this was the perfect movie for Tobey Maguire. Like, the whole point of it with that crazy premise is that you need someone who is that's a completely alien state of being for who they are and how they operate, and that's interesting. And I remember as soon as he said that, I was like, You're right. And it became like this lens through which I like looked at all sorts of movies. And it's not that like the worst thing has to be it's not always that the opposites like Tobey Maguire and Crank, but it's the idea that the premise should be a direct challenge to the core sense of identity, hopes, dreams, and aspirations of this protagonist. Jason Statham, you're like, well, today you're going to have to kick a bunch of ass and race in some cars and kiss some beautiful women. He'd be like, it's a Wednesday. Like,
I was born for this.
Right? There's no challenge. And that, as silly as that like offhand comment he made at a party when we were hanging out, like that clearly, you know, 15 years later in my mind, I'm like, that's kind of been my key for looking at every time I'm creating a world. I'm going, you know, how can I make sure that it's Tobey Maguire and not Jason Statham?
Well, you know, I have to say, this conversation has gone in like 27 different directions that I could not have anticipated, but I could not be any happier with it, because I think that is the perfect takeaway for a lot of writers out there and how we think about world building. Because one of the challenges that I see are these just vast worlds, and they've done so much development and all of these like the political trees of all the ruling families and all of this Game of Thrones, you know, like all of this data. But what is the data doing?
Oh, can I answer that? I don't know if you were wrapping
up
because we're done.
No. I want to make sure I'm respecting your time, but if you want to drop any more mind-blowing truth bombs.
I would talk about this for hours. This is my favorite stuff. So I think Game of Thrones is actually a perfect example, and I use it in that lecture that I give about centering, having a clearly meaningful world and then centering it on a character. Game of Thrones, I mean, when it first came out, a lot of the press was just about like, look at how much blood and nudity there is. And it was the HBOification of, you know, this isn't your grandpa's fantasy. And very quickly the show understood like that has limited appeal, and like maybe that will force some like people to, or encourage them to like check it out for the first time. But like, if you want to hang with that series, you actually have to like work a lot harder. And it's a pretty, I mean, it's a huge cast. It's a complicated world. But one of the things that George R. R. Martin, he's incredibly consistent with the world. And there's this great quote he has, that if you have show notes, you can find it easily. I think it's an interview in Rolling Stone. Someone's asking about like how Game of Thrones is a rebuke of Tolkien. And you can see that Martin doesn't really want to like tear down Tolkien, but the critique that he gives is just so beautiful, where I'm going to paraphrase here, but he's like, ruling is hard. Like at the end of Lord of the Rings, spoiler, it says Aragorn is a good and just king for 100 years, or whatever it is. And he's like, really? Like, what happened to the orcs after they were vanquished? Like, did the army then sweep into the villages and murder all of the little orc babies in their little orc cribs? And then did Aragorn, like, what was his tax policy? Did he have a standing army to make sure there wasn't retribution from the orcs who had legitimately been slaughtered? And why are we even, and this goes to, like, larger Marxist critiques that you get with people like Michael Moorcock with fantasy, where it's like, why are we assuming a king is a good thing? We assume that in a fantasy, a happy ending is a good king. But in most of history, good governance comes from no king or an incredibly abridged, a king abridged in their powers, like in a, you know, constitutional monarchy or something. And his point was like, he wanted Westeros to be an example of like, it's always compromise. It's always a game. You are always going to violate your principles. And so he actually, I think, for that first book and the first season of the show, did create the perfect protagonist, because you have Ned Stark, who is a man of principle, mm-hmm. a man who does his duty, does the thing he agreed to, even if it's incredibly inconvenient and painful to him, to the point that he married a woman that he knew didn't love him because of this sense of duty. Over and over again, he does the right thing. And the world of Westeros is a perfect rebuke to that. And the gutsy thing, the compelling thing that George R. R. Martin did was say, I am so committed to my view of this world that I'm going to show you how it chews up and destroys a Ned Stark. But those two were made for each other. I would argue that minus Ned Stark in the equation, it would have just been an incoherent mess of seedy jerks. It would have been like House of Cards, right?
Yeah.
You know, everyone's double dealing and a jerk. And then you watch a whole season, you're like, what? Yep, everyone's double dealing and a jerk. And really, it's because they didn't create that character who was sort of the thing that we were going to process the world through and critique the world through. So to me, actually, like, that was the appeal of Game of Thrones. I think it's also
and when he dies, our whole understanding of the world and how the world works is really set in motion. I think it's very interesting to kill off a focal character, a protagonist character, in like the opening act, really.
Yeah, but I think that again, that became like, it just raised the stakes of like, all right, in most stories, the one noble man can beat the corrupt system.
Yeah.
Didn't work. So let's see what different kinds of men and women can beat this system. I think half the reason the series failed is because it violated its core premise, which is that there could be a peaceful resolution. I was expecting the series, and I think weirdly it would have made us all feel icky and sad, but I thought the series was going to end with this terrifying power vacuum where literally I could see it in my mind. I had always assumed that Littlefinger or whichever conniver is still alive would be like, and the Game of Thrones begins anew. And they would pan out and you'd see armies mobilizing across whatever the 17 different, you know, domains and kingdoms. And I'm like, that would have been awful and cheap and completely consistent with the reality of the world they
with
created.
The premise. Yeah.
And the idea that they somehow found a good and just magical ruler who was going to succeed at ruling felt like a violation. The series had gone very clearly out of its way to show us that a good, just man loses his head. and so for me, that's the beginning of that series, and then what HBO does in the end of the series is a perfect example of when you do have your world anchored to a character who's a perfect fit for it. Right? It's like a hand in a glove, and when you lose that, you know, episodes 7, 8, 9 of Star Wars, you write stuff that is good, but doesn't get where we needed it to go because
doesn't pluck those heartstrings.
So yeah, I think of, if we talk character first, I think the whole point of the world is as a crucible and mirror for what a character is going through.
Oh my God. This has been the most fascinating conversation. Again, you could talk about this for hours. I could chat with you for hours. We have to depart, but I want to thank you so much. And you say nobody calls you a visual writer. I will I will leave us with, this has been an interview with Jonathan Auxier, the visual writer of books like Sweep and Peter Nimble and the new series, The Fabled Stables, for even younger readers. Thank you so much for just such a juicy, far-ranging and incredibly insightful conversation. I couldn't be happier.
Oh, absolutely. This is such a joy. Thank you so much, Mary. And thank you for doing this. I think this is a big value and help to writers at every level who are wanting to think about craft.
I know it will be for me in my own thinking about world building. I'm Mary Cole. This has been Good Story Podcast, and here's to a good story.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Good Story Podcast. My name is Mary Cole, and I want to extend my deepest gratitude to the Good Story Company team, Kristen Overman, Amy Wilson, Rhiannon Richardson, Joya Morrison Efemini, Kate London, Mikal Leah, Jenna Van Roy, Kathy Martin Olich, Len Katan Prugel, Rebecca Landesman, Steve Reese, and Gigi Collins. Please check us out at goodstorycompany.com. And I would love it if you joined Good Story Learning, a monthly membership with new content added where you can learn everything you ever wanted to know and more about writing and publishing for writers of all categories and ability levels. Thanks again for listening, and here's to a good story. Mm-hmm.